Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 100 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Thank you for getting me this far. I can't believe it's been 100 episodes already. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at @infectiousmyth. Listen to us at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download the program after broadcast using iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners. But if you want this show and other independent media to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Today we will be tracking the difficult subject of sex crimes and pedophilia. My guest, a legal expert in this area, will show just how broad the definitions have become, so that people you would probably agree are not even criminals or at worst deserve a minor punishment are thrown into the same category as a small number of people, mostly men, who do perpetrate horrible sex crimes on either adults or children. How did America end up with hundreds of thousands of people on sex crime registries? And should we have any empathy for some of those people? Heather Ellis Kukolo is an adjunct professor and the current director of New York Law School's Online Mental Disability Law Program. She has taught courses on sex offenders, mental disability law, race, gender, class, and culture, therapeutic jurisprudence, and the Americans with Disabilities Act. She's represented individuals facing civil commitment under both the New Jersey Mental Hygiene Law and the state's Sexually Violent Predators Act. She's published and lectured in these same areas around the world. She's a recognized expert in sexual violent predator law and has counseled attorneys, judges, and clinicians on law and procedures and civil commitments and issues involving persons suffering from a mental disability or illness within the criminal justice system. Some of her articles include Far From the Turbulent Space, They're Planting Stories in the Press, The Impact of Media Distortions on Sex Offender Law and Policy, The Treatment of Sex Offenders, Evidence, Ethics, and Human Rights. And she's also co-authored a 7-part mental disability law treatise with Michael Perlin, which is due out this year. Welcome to the show, Heather. I'm glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much. If I can just add one more publication.
Sure, yeah.
Michael Perlin and I also just finished a book. It's probably due to be out in the summer by Temple Press. It's called Shaming the Constitution. And it really goes in depth into sex offender legislation, issues, the science, international concerns. Kind of talks about all of the prevailing issues in this area.
So. Okay, well, thank you for that update. I came across your name in a recent Vice article on people jailed for sex crimes at a young age who remain behind bars even after their sentence finished. And it's somewhat seems unrelated, but just recently, Dennis Hastert, I think maybe yesterday or the day before, was sentenced not for being a pedophile, but for hiding financial transactions that were illegal. And he admitted to the judge that he had molested at least 3 children. But one person wrote to the judge, Gail Coletta of the Florida Action Committee, I don't know exactly what this is, and she wrote, "Today, there are over 800,000 individuals in the United States on sex offender registries. Some, like Mr. Hastert, committed heinous crimes against multiple victims, but others committed nonviolent one-time offenses yet are being punished for life as a consequence of the harshly punitive laws that Mr. Hastert passed." So who are these people who are in this kind of limbo in America who are classified as sex offenders and yet, if we knew about their crimes, we might not see them as sort of the classic pedophile?
Sure. Well, so sex offender is a huge overriding umbrella term, and it really is not at all descriptive in terms of understanding what exactly constitutes sexual offense legally, psychologically, psychiatrically. I mean, there's so many different ways to consider this. But to answer your question directly, for instance, it depended on certain states have their own specific state registration systems. Other states have opted into the federal registration system under the Adam Walsh Act, which is a federally mandated act. But a whole range of types of offenses can potentially cause someone to be placed onto this registry, such as urinating in public. If that is a specified convicted offense, it can be used as a predicate or a precursor offense to being placed on the sex offender registry.
Just that alone, like it's and not that
just that alone.
And yeah. I was going to ask you actually, are there things that could get you on the sex crimes registry in one state that in another state would be legal? I mean, I presume urination, public urination might be one of those, but are there other things like the age difference between, say, two teenagers or something like that?
I mean, that's one example, definitely, when you're talking about sex that is consensual but illegal. And, you know, certainly there are different legal ages of consent. I think at one point, I'm blanking on the state, at one point a state still had the legal age of consent at 13, actually. But I think that's recently been changed or changed in the last maybe 5 to 10 years. But I think universally at this point, I'm fairly sure that the age of consent usually falls around 16, 17, 18. But still, of course, there are, you know, depending on whether or not it's going to be classified as a crime, certainly in one state where the age of consent is 18 versus another state where the age of consent is 16. And obviously if you went to the state with the higher consent age and you're with an individual who's a 16-year-old, then it would be a crime in that state, although not a crime in the other one.
I mean, I guess you could end up with a situation where you have a young couple who are both under the age of consent, that as soon as one of them goes over the age of consent, sex becomes a crime. Is that right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and I think this kind of really brings into a bigger picture of the idea of sort of what is a crime versus what is something that we're trying to prevent against in terms of like sexual deviancy.
Right. I mean, in the Dennis Hastert case, for people who maybe aren't aware of him, I'd kind of forgotten his name until this came up, but he was a very powerful politician. He was the Speaker of the House of Congress. When he was a wrestling coach in the 70s, he molested at least three members, boys of in his wrestling team. And that's kind of more of a classic sexual offense, what people think of when they think of sex crimes.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think when somebody hears a sex crime, I think immediately they're going to think of someone who is molesting children. The clinical diagnosis that can be linked to that is pedophilia. But that, of course, is, again, you know, that's what most, I think that's in terms of what the public will kind of go to. They'll either go to, you know, the media sensationalized types of crimes that we hear about, which is crimes against children, right, or horrific violent rapes. That's sort of what comes into mind initially, when in fact they're not the most common types of sex offenses, according to studies that have been done, are actually incest, interfamilial type situations. Those are have been studied to be the most prevalent types of offending behaviors.
Right, and I imagine most of those go undetected since they presumably mostly happen
exactly
inside the house. Now this says,
exactly,
well, this lady who wrote about Dennis Hastert, I mean, this number really shocked me. She said there's over 800,000 individuals on sex offender registries. Is that an accurate number in the United States?
It's a huge amount of individuals on statewide registries, yes. So that adds, I don't actually have the most recent, but that certainly that does not sound like an inaccurate number.
I mean, that's just huge, and it would be hard to believe that there's 800,000 people who are like old men sexually molesting six-year-olds or something, right? Like, I think that's relatively rare. So most of these probably were convicted of things that we might not really see as a crime, or at least not a crime requiring life in jail. But you've, in this article in Vice, you talked about a man who ended up in jail after his sentence was completed, which brings up another a variety of issues. But how does that happen?
Well, so about 20 states and the federal government under a recent 2010 case of United States versus Comstock have determined that persons who have been deemed sexual predators who can be civilly committed as such after they have already served their time in prison. So what happens is someone commits an offense that is classified or qualifies as a sexual offense, and they serve their time. There's a variety of procedural situations that can occur. They can be screened right from prison to see whether or not they meet the criteria for the civil commitment. They can be out on the street, and their parole officer can suggest that they be screened for civil commitment. They can be serving a non-sex crime in prison and then be screened for something that occurred, you know, 20 years back. But what does happen is then this individual is looked at. Pretty much the criteria within the 20 states is pretty much the same in the sense that it requires a qualifying act. Now, so when I say qualifying act, it has to be something that the statute from each state says is the type of offense that will get the person the first step of their foot in the door for civil commitment. So, but that act doesn't necessarily have to be sexual.
So you were talking about public urination. I mean, if you were arrested for public urination 10 years before what you were thrown in jail for, would that count as part of the
probably
civil commitment?
Probably not. I mean, probably not. I don't think that, you know, these civil commitment programs are really expensive. I know they did a study that it's about $160,000 to $180,000 per person per year. And states have upwards of thousands. I mean, California has thousands. New Jersey, who had 600 to 700 to 800 people in and out. But anyway, so no. What I guess when I say, you know, sort of not, it could be, let's say, in New Jersey, there was a case where the person qualified for civil commitment under the crime that they committed, although there was no sexual act involved. But what was believed was that there was sexual underpinnings, or that there was an attempt, or not an attempt even, sorry, but that if things would have been allowed to progress, it was believed that it may have been sexually motivated.
So like an assault again, or something?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was no charge or no conviction of any type of sexual assault or sexual offense. But that crime was allowed to serve as the predicate offense for civil commitment, meaning the offense that they can use. Some states require two offenses. Most states only require one. And then that's just the first step. And then the next step is the person has to suffer from a mental abnormality or personality disorder. And that's different from just, you know, I know we think of mental illness, but mental abnormality or personality disorder can kind of, it's been really left open-ended by the courts. And it's pretty much dependent on sort of when a psychiatrist or psychologist testifies what they think would be a mental abnormality. And then that has to be linked to future dangerousness. So then they have to say that because they have this condition, they are going to commit future crimes of sexual violence. And states have couched that in terms of likely to commit, highly likely to commit, more likely than not to commit. It varies.
So you have, like, in this case, in this example, you have that there was an assault, and maybe somebody stopped the assault, and they think that it would have resulted in a sex crime. They think this person has a mental abnormality, so if he gets out, I presume it's a guy, if he gets out, he's going to do again what we think he would have done if the assault had completed, which is a lot of thought crimes.
A lot of thought crimes, exactly. And like exactly as, you know, it's funny, I spoke, you mentioned the Vice article, and it was, you know, great, and Aviva was wonderful. I spoke with her for a couple hours, but, I mean, I think one of the most, you know, probably salient aspects of what I said was talking about the movie Minority Report, and I feel like, so I'm dating myself, because now that movie is actually a little older. It used to be recent, but, yeah, but, you know, if anybody remembers, you know, with Tom Cruise and that whole idea of being able to predict the crime and prevent it before it happens. But we know that absent, you know, science fiction technology, which we don't have, I mean, that's nearly impossible. And in fact, psychiatrists, psychologists, researchers have said that, you know, basically it's a 50-50 chance. We truly can't know.
Right. I often think, you know, when somebody does something horrendous and, you know, people will go back and they'll look and say, well, we should have seen the signs that something was going to happen. The problem is that if you look at 1 million people, you might see those signs, and 1,000 people, of which one of them is actually going to do the heinous crime, and you can't really tell. Like, it seems logical. It's like people who play violent video games. Some people think they're more likely to become criminals, but certainly not all of them. Most of them are happy staying in the basement playing their violent video games.
That's absolutely right, yeah. In terms of, like, recidivism rates or rates of reoffense, it's in fact, sex offenders have the lowest reoffense rates than any other type of criminal.
And
Is
there a lot of treatment in prisons for sex offenders?
That's a great question. Some states offer treatment in prison. Other states do not because prison is punitive and not rehabilitative.
It's not supposed to be that way, but that seems to be the the way it is.
Exactly. Once and if a state has sex offender civil commitment, and once a person is put in that sex offender civil commitment, the idea is that the purpose is to treat the individual. But really, though, the jury is out, so to speak, in terms of whether or not there is treatment that really works for this population. And yeah, treatment's a whole nother ball game because can be applied sparingly, it can be applied improperly, and we just really don't know we don't really have any studies or statistics that really say that the cognitive behavioral or the treatment methods that have been applied, especially in the United States, really have had much, if any, benefit on preventing recidivism or reducing risk.
I mean, could you get into kind of a Kafkaesque situation where you know, you did an assault because maybe you were trying to rob some money off a woman. It was interpreted as potentially sexual, but you know that it wasn't. Some psychiatrist says you've got a mental abnormality, which is not a mental illness, as you pointed out. And now you basically have to admit that you have a sexual problem and that you're dealing with it in order to get out. Is that like what you get trapped in?
You have literally just written the script.
Really?
Absolutely. I could not have given a better scenario because yes, that's exactly what happens. That's exactly what happens. Yes, of course. Are there people that have committed offenses and, you know, sexual offenses, have admitted to them, have been civilly committed and have, you know, sure, that scenario happens. But certainly, yeah, there are also a large percentage, though, of individuals who either, there are two problems. One, exactly as you had said, you know, let's say they're convicted at trial, but yet they still maintain, look, this is not the way it happened. But yet it doesn't matter because what's on the record is on the record. And yes, somebody testifies the fact that you have this abnormality. 80% of persons in prison, by the way, have an antisocial personality disorder, and this is just general prison. So it's pretty easy to get a diagnosis of a personality or antisocial personality disorder or mental abnormality if you have engaged in any type of criminal activity. So, right. So it's easy to get that diagnosis and then to, of course, make the link. The other scenario and one of the other problems is that, so when we're talking about the criminal aspect of sex offenses, a lot of times prosecutors don't have the evidence that they need to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So what do? They seek to get a plea deal. So a lot of guys will plead guilty for a lower sentence, and when you plead guilty, you're pleading to all of the facts of the case. You're just not going to court and in trial in that sense. But you plead guilty thinking, okay, well, this is great. You know, I'm only going to get, you know, a couple years and I'll be out. Well, if you're then in a state that has civil commitment and you're screened for civil commitment, well, guess what? You just plead guilty to a sex offense or underlying elements of sexual offending. And, you know, you plead guilty, therefore it happened, although it may not have. That may have just been a strategy. So that's another problem.
Well, there's a shocking number of people, I think, especially in America, who plead guilty in order, because they're threatened with like a 30-year sentence if they go to trial versus 2 years if they take the plea deal, even if they didn't do it.
That and incompetent, unfortunately, incompetent defense attorneys as well that just, you know, don't want to put the work in and just kind of want to get that case out of the way.
I mean, is this really, I would imagine that an upper middle class who has a son who gets in some kind of trouble that could be interpreted as a sex offense, like he has a girlfriend under the age, like he's 18 and she's 16, and that violates the whatever the age of consent is, that they would hire a good lawyer, and the chances are that if there was punishment, it would be minimal, versus like a poor kid who got a public defender. Is there a big disparity there in terms of what the sentences would be?
So that's a tough call, and I'll tell you why. Definitely socioeconomic factors are in play here, but it's so dependent. Sometimes, for instance, so at the criminal level, yes, probably maybe because it depends. Sometimes the public defenders are going to be much more equipped to handle these issues than a private attorney. I can tell you, though, in the civil commitment sense, when they're screened for civil commitment, usually, you know, individuals that have money, they'll think, oh, I'm going to hire a private attorney, when in fact, you know, for the most part, public defenders that work in that area are specialized in those issues. And in fact, you're much better off. But yes, in that, I mean, when we're talking about the criminal level, sure. I mean, I think it's with any other type of offense. I mean, of course, the sanctions are just that more drastic because of these sex offender registries, that if you, you know, do get convicted or you do take the wrong plea, you have the potential of being listed on a registry for life, possibly.
So civil commitment basically means that you end up back in jail. Is that what the commitment means, or could you be in civil commitment on parole?
No. There's no least restrictive alternative. Least restrictive alternative meaning something less than involuntary confinement. Now, a majority of the civil commitment centers are absolutely housed in prisons. Although they're usually a separate part of the prison because this is not prison. You know, it can't violate the ex post facto rules of being laws of being. Punished twice for the same crime. So it's seen as treatment. It's seen as, you know, they want to equate it to civil commitment of mentally ill individuals. And we talk about just general involuntary civil commitment in a hospital. But these are definitely not hospitals. There's barbed wire. A lot of them are run by Department of Corrections. They're locked in solitary confinement. They have cells.
So it's just another wing of the prison, but we're not going to call it a prison because we can't.
It really is. I mean, it really is. Look, you look at, like, Washington, I think McNeil Island. So they built this, like, state-of-the-art facility, you know. And sure, yes, I guess it's separate, and it's great. It's basically a prison. I mean, yes, they have a little more leeway in terms of, I guess, being able to walk around a little more freely within the walls. But, you know, they're not allowed out. And it's worse than a prison sentence, unless, of course, it's a prison sentence for, like, murder. Because it's worse than a prison sentence because involuntary civil commitment has no end date.
Yeah, I think you mentioned one state where only one person had ever got out of civil commitment.
Right. So really kind of interesting and kind of like right on the radar currently is Minnesota. There's some major kind of legislation going on, or legislation. There's some major court cases going on, the Carson versus Jensen's case. But and basically it was saying that, you know, this program's been around for 20-plus years, and no one had ever been released.
So basically civil commitment, like you say, it's worse than jail, basically means that you're in jail for life in Minnesota anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, pretty much in every state that has this. Some states release a little bit more. You know, they might be able to show a little more of they've released this person, that person here and there. But no, for the most part, it potentially can lead to a life sentence in the sense that you're locked up forever. And as much as I think that the only way to keep sex offenders locked up past their prison sentence is through civil commitment without violating double jeopardy and ex post facto laws. But the fact is that the purpose, I don't believe, is for treatment and rehabilitation. The purpose is to keep these people off the streets forever.
Right, and
you understand. The public would say, great.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are some people who clearly would be dangerous to release, but I would imagine that would be a handful of people, but not 100% of the people who managed to get this civil commitment, which seems a pretty low bar.
And that's the one way to look at it, right? So when you say that, right, so not everybody in civil commitment is going to be that dangerous person, right?
Yes.
Well, on the other hand, there are people that are extremely dangerous that just were never screened for civil commitment for whatever reason.
And they're going to get let out.
And they're going to get let out. And we, you know, it's so arbitrary. There's no rhyme or reason. In fact, my other favorite popular culture sort of thing, and this is at least a little more contemporary, although I'm still probably getting to date myself, but I always say, like, if you're a big Lord of the Rings fan, and you know how, like, the eye, it just depends on what the eye is focusing on.
Right.
I mean, that's just, it's just the way it is. Like, which way is the eye turning? You know, is it focusing on, you know, John Doe over here and not, you know, Stan Doe over there? I mean, it's so arbitrary. Yes, you know, they'll say that they have certain, you know, characteristics or certain statistics, who they're screening, who they're not, but the fact is that it's extremely arbitrary.
Who initiates this screening? Is it the prosecutor? Is it the jail towards the end of the sentence?
Yeah, that's a great question, and both, in fact. It can be, it depends on the state, either or. It can be the prison. The administrators suggest, you know, they have a set criteria, and they'll say, okay, you know, these individuals fall under that criteria, thus, you know, they're going to be screened. And when I say screened, I mean they're going to have, I guess, two clinicians. Usually it's like two clinicians. Again, varies from state to state, but let's just say from New Jersey, two clinicians come. They don't even have to interview the person, but they just write like a two-page report saying that they meet.
Really?
That they meet the criteria for civil commitment. And then at that point, they begin the process of being temporarily civilly committed, where they're transferred to the civil commitment institution. And then at that point, they're assigned counsel, usually, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when they start the process of having a trial or a hearing for civil commitment.
And this
for involuntary.
This data, like if you were in jail and let's say that some people in the jail didn't really like you, they didn't like your attitude or something like that,
mm-hmm.
they could start this process, and then the documentation that you would get would be mostly coming from the jail, right?
Absolutely.
So if you've made the mistake of saying, you know, look, I'm going to be out of here in 6 months, so, you know, kind of got a bit of an attitude, not doing anything wrong, but they don't like your attitude, they could say, sure, yeah, you think you're going to get out in 6 months, but actually you're going to spend the rest of your life behind bars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, those dynamics are in play. Yes, they are. They're in play everywhere. They're certainly in play here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just imagining that, but in your experience, are there particular reasons why some people get picked for this treatment and others are let out at the end of their sentences?
Wow, that is such a great question. I don't know that anybody has actually ever asked me that. And I'm thinking from all of my experience, I can tell you this. Those who are developmentally disabled, persons with an intellectual developmental mm-hmm. disability, are much more likely to be screened and placed into civil commitment.
Like the assumption being if they're, what am I called, slow, what used to be mentally retarded that therefore they can't control their urges and we let them out, they're just going to do it again, whatever it was.
Exactly. It's just a very, sort of the stigma, the kind of sanism involved in terms of how those types of individuals are perceived is just compounded when you have that issue of a sex offense involved. So much more readily. Other than that, I have had clients that never had any type of penetrative offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking adult, by the way. I'm not talking
right.
children. I'm talking someone that had a altercation with a peer, with an adult, an altercation with a peer, and it was a claim of groping. And that individual has been in civil commitment for about, 15 years and going. I've had individuals who never actually committed a offense on the outside. The individual was in a juvenile correction facility, and it was an assault, but it was between him and his roommate, and that was the qualifying offense that got him then civilly committed.
It was an assault, not a sexual assault, just an assault.
It was a sexual assault. It was a sexual assault. Yeah, it definitely was a sexual assault. But again, it happened in a juvenile correction center. And so it's funny, as I'm talking about this, I'm remembering standing up in front of the appellate court in
right.
New Jersey, making the argument that how can we say that this person is going to be likely to commit acts of sexual violence in the community when they've actually never committed in the community. And of course, that didn't fly at all, because they said, well, look, this person committed an offense under supervision. But I think, again, legally it's so tough to sort of make a legal argument under this. But I think when we're thinking about it from a clinical point of view, from a sociological point of view, et cetera, we look at, well, what are the dynamics in a juvenile detention facility?
Mm-hmm.
Or what can be the dynamics?
Right.
And this was not a sexual assault because of a sexual disorder or deviance. This was a power situation.
Right.
Now, But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter.
Well, plus you've got kids who are into a case of forced celibacy at the time when their sexual drive is the highest. It doesn't excuse what happened, but it
of
doesn't necessarily
not.
Mean that when you get out into a more normal environment that you'd go sexually assault people when you could actually date somebody, which is not, of course, possible in a prison.
I think you make the point that is kind of like, I think always when we're talking about, the registry and civil commitment versus a crime, like, it doesn't make a difference whether or not the person had a sexual intent or had just an anger intent or whatever, for criminal purposes. You know what? They committed a crime. They need to be punished. But when we're talking about this whole concept of locking people up because of this fear that they're going to repeat offend over and over and over again, I just maintain that it needs to be more. It has to be the belief that they're going to offend because they have this uncontrollable or uncontainable or some semblance of not being able to control this desire to act out harmfully and sexually.
Right.
And for the most part, most of the cases that I had, most of the cases that I see, if there was a sexual offense that occurred or a sexual assault that occurred, it occurred because of an antisocial personality disorder. It occurred because they were just disregarding the rights of others. And it wasn't about, you know, having a deviant, this need to commit a sexual offense. It was just a crime amidst a number of crimes, non-sexual,
right,
that they were committing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they should be, you know, that should be ignored. But we're talking about
not.
Basically permanent
not.
Jailing on the basis of one
right.
or two
right.
events, which were not under, like you say, were not in this case, was not in a normal circumstance. It was within a jail, a circumstance where tensions are much higher. In these civil commitment cases, what you know, do they always result in commitment, or is there a good chance that somebody will avoid the commitment process once they've been put into it?
Let's say the chances of them it depends. Again, it depends on the state. It does, but no, the chances of being committed are extremely high. I mean, as an example, and again, I think I was a very effective, you know, defense attorney in civil commitment, in sex offender civil commitment in New Jersey. So I guess we can say out of 200 cases,
mm-hmm.
I was successful in 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
And obviously you knew what you were doing because
yes,
you
I
had
did.
So much
yes.
experience. And
yes,
and even so,
that.
So the odds are pretty much stacked against you once you're aligned for, or, you know, once you're set up for civil
yes.
commitment, it's always going to happen. But there are people who get out and they have a sex crime on their record. Is mm-hmm. everybody with a sex crime on their record in the sex crime registry in America?
That's a great question, and it's so dependent on whether or not we're talking about kind of the state registry and what the criteria is, or the federal. So we can kind of talk about like the Adam Walsh Act.
Okay, explain
now,
that.
Yeah, so the Adam Walsh Act, it's a comprehensive Federal Registration Act, and the purpose of it was to have conformity amongst the states in terms of registration, so that we all have the same, basically. And there's the way that it works, it follows along very closely to New Jersey's Megan's Law, which I think most people are familiar with. It was developed as the heinous, horrible murder of Megan Tanka, who was 7 years old. Megan's Law was sort of the major legislation that developed in terms of registration.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of states followed suit, and the Adam Walsh Act federally is kind of based off of this. So it has three tiers. Tier one, offenders register from 10 to 15 years upon release. Tier two, individuals are going to register for at least 25 years. And then tier three, they register for life.
And what does it mean in practical terms to be on a registry like this? Like, can you, in terms of getting a job, getting housing,
exactly.
that kind of stuff?
Well, there's a whole bunch of restrictions. You can have restrictions of where you can live, how many feet you're allowed to live from certain areas that have children. And now, mind you, these are blanket restrictions. So let's say your sexual offense was only against adults. You never offended against
right.
a child. It doesn't matter. You still have the restrictions of where you can live near children. You have to check in with your local police department on these specific times. Depending on the tiers, too, there's different rules,
mm-hmm.
different things that you have to comply with. But you have to always be registering your, it certainly affects jobs, certainly affects where you can live, certainly, affects how you are treated in the community. Treatment can be mandated or not mandated, it all depends.
Right, So, could you end up with a situation where, say, somebody has a fight with their girlfriend, and there's, say, a sexual component, say he grabs her breast or something, and that becomes a sex crime, but she's an adult, he's an adult, now he couldn't work in a school because he's got children, even though his crime had nothing to do with children. And even if he deals with his anger problems that led to this, then that's still not going to change the 10 to 15 year.
Nope, absolutely. A good sort of story example of just that, in the sense of, I don't know if any, you know, if anybody, if you remember, sort of the restrictions that kind of pop up in the newspapers during Halloween. Sex offenders aren't allowed to leave their house. They have to have their lights, or individuals who are on the registry have to have their lights off, can't leave their house. Police come by and do random checks. There was a situation of, you know, of a guy who was, I don't remember the age, but I remember the proximity of the ages. He was, let's say, 19, and his girlfriend at the time was 16, and they were in a relationship, and they were having sexual relations, and I guess maybe, let's say, the age of consent was 17, and their parents found out, and they were angry, and mm-hmm. they pressed charges, and, you know, he didn't go to jail or anything, but he was placed on the registry. Well, they're married now, and he can't take his children out for Halloween because he's on the registry, and he has to stay locked inside of his house. I mean, you just kind of think about, again, you know, yes, I know I'm talking about a lot about this other cohort, but the thing is this cohort's huge. And yes, there are people that absolutely, there are sex offenders who are on the registry, they've committed terrible crimes.
Yes.
No doubt about it, but the problem is that it's a blanket restriction. It covers everyone without any rhyme or reason. And there was this great study done out of Rutgers talking about Megan's Law in New Jersey, which, as I said, is mm-hmm. pretty much similar to any other registry. They did a study that looked at 10 years before Megan's Law was enacted and 10 mm-hmm. years after Megan's Law was enacted, and they found that there was absolutely no difference whatsoever in the number of sexual offenses or crimes.
And
do
people who do have, a genuine, say, genuine inclinations towards pedophilia as opposed to sex crimes in general, mm-hmm. do they have more difficulty dealing with their issues under these tighter restrictions? I mean, is there evidence that they are more likely to commit another crime if they find it difficult to get a job, difficult to find housing, things like that? Is that actually exacerbating the problem?
Again, definitely. You're absolutely correct. There have been scholars, studies have shown or have looked at the stressors that if someone is going to kind of, if there's that roadmap that's going to lead someone to want to act out and act out sexually again, there are certain stressors and things that kind of build up that are going to create more of a risk. And certainly those stressors are, you know, being ostracized from society, not mm-hmm. having a job, not having proper housing, proper support, et cetera. Yeah, all of these things certainly are not going to help and potentially might hurt. They could, but they're certainly not helping.
Yes. Are there any improvements that are being made in this area? I mean, I think America has been through this whole tough on crime several decades of let's mm-hmm. crack down more and more, and I think the evidence is coming in that it's just backfiring. But are there places where maybe a little bit more common sense is coming in and improvements in these areas, or are people just doubling down on these laws?
Again, such another great question. The article that Michael Perlin and I wrote together, they're planning stories in the press. Kind of what I wanted to do is I went through sort of all of the media before current, just looking at as well in the laws and looking at how sort of our views have changed. And yes, you're absolutely right. I think that there is a lot more education and certainly knowledge is kind of getting out there in terms of the low recidivism rates, in the fact that these legislative measures are not necessarily effective, but two things. Well, yeah. Not two, more than two. But
I'm sure there's a long list.
No politician is going to ever advocate to overturn any of this stuff. Of course not.
Right.
No person, no community member is going to say, you know, this is unconstitutional, or we're infringing on persons' human rights. We really need to not do this.
Right.
Even if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. Megan Kanka's mom, when she heard the study about Megan's Law and that it had no effect, she said, well, we never, you know, the purpose of the registry was never to stop sex offenses. It was just to let us know who's out there.
Uh-oh.
And I think that says a lot. It's kind of like this voyeuristic, you know, how many people are going to jump on the watchdog site or have already, you know, to look at who's near them, who's in their area that's on the registry. Of course, most of the time it doesn't tell you much of anything about the crimes or anything about the person. But it's just any time, you know, we have fear.
Yes.
I can understand that. You know, I 100% can understand that. It's just that it's not rationally related to the legislation that we've created. But again, I think that, okay, well, I think that states have pulled back on registry restrictions in terms of kind of these really outrageous. There was, you know, stuff going on in Florida about offenders having to live under a bridge because, in essence, they've sort of been banished. There's, like, nowhere else for them to live. And states have begun to pull back a little bit on that. But, again, I don't think that there are going to be really any major overhauls because, you know, sex offenders are the most despised individuals. They're monsters. They're pariahs in the community. And people have these gut reactions of hate and anger, as well as understood. But it's, you know, as much as the media, I think, has focused a lot on, again, the lower recidivism, all of these other issues, it just takes one event, you know, one event to pop up on the news, and people are up in arms.
Right. I mean, the powerful thing about a word like sex offender is that you lump in, you know, the 60-year-old man who kidnapped a 6-year-old girl and violently raped her with the 19-year-old who had a 16-year-old girlfriend who he later married, right? Which
exactly.
These are two, they're not even on the same spectrum, I don't think. And
let's not forget the teachers, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's been the big thing, too. You know, all cross-flashed on the news are these very attractive women in their 20s having sex with their, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old students. But they're sex offenders, too.
Well, actually, that's interesting because at the University in Canada, they're thinking about passing a law that would ban sex between faculty and students. From my perspective, I was actually a student at university. I still am, basically, and I'm older than most of my professors. So with a law like that, if I had a relationship with a professor who was younger than me, then she might be considered to be the sex offender, right? Like, just because of the way the thing was structured, because of the power structure.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, the power structure. I mean, I don't think that could be a criminal, but certainly administratively, you know, certainly she could be sanctioned, fired,
yes,
et
cetera. Yes,
yes. Yeah, no, of course.
It's definitely immoral to have a relationship with your student, whether they're older or younger than you. But whether, like you say, whether it's a criminal offense and whether you should have your whole life turned upside down for what's a mistake of an understandable passion, that's, I guess, where the problem is. Anyway, this is a fascinating discussion. We're kind of running out of time. I guess one more question is, have you personally received pushback because you're a woman, you know, defending pedophiles? Have you paid a personal price for your work in this area?
That's a great question, and I actually get asked that a lot. And I think, yes, you know, certainly I think socially and, you know, social, I mean, I'm not invited to a lot of cocktail parties.
Neither am I.
But, you know, no. You know, yes, I mean, I do think, you know, not only am I a woman, when I started practicing too, you know, I was in my mid to late 20s, you know, a younger woman. And yes, there's definitely a sort of a different, I guess, way of looking at, you know, what I do or why I would defend these individuals. And certainly, I think, you know, it never would defend actions, but you defend people's human rights and their constitutional rights. Because, again, you know, we judge a society by how it treats whom they perceive to be the lowest of their members, and we have to afford everyone the rights and liberties.
Okay, thank you. That's a good answer. Yeah, I think that the more people know about this, the more complicated they understand that it is, and that simplistic solutions, which are often applied after, say, a particularly heinous crime, don't work well when they're applied across a huge spectrum of people. Anyway, thank you for joining me, and I'll send you a link to the podcast when it goes up next week.
Wonderful. Great. No, it was great. Thank you so much for talking to me and exploring these issues. I appreciate it.
It was very interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Another
area of U.S. justice that has a lot of problems is the pardons process. Everyone knows now that the war on drugs and tough-on-crime policies has sentenced many people to lengthy sentences, even life, for minor drug trafficking charges or minor violent crimes, as my guest pointed out. The New York Times on March 30th wrote about the resignation of the U.S. pardon attorney, Deborah Leff, who stated that she was unable to perform her duties effectively because of interference from the Department of Justice. She complained about inadequate staffing, that she'd been told to set aside thousands of petitions, and that the Department of Justice had prevented the White House from knowing about recommendations for clemency that she had made, a policy they reversed only after she resigned. The Department of Justice still controls this office, however, and the New York Times editorial board are justifiably skeptical that it can be effective when controlled by the very prosecutors who sent people down the river 10, 20, 30 years ago. As the article pointed out, the pardons process is at the wrong end of the justice system for real reform, but is one of the few ways to undo the wrongs done to millions of people by tough-on-crime and war-on-drugs policies. I contacted Deborah Leff, but she told me that she wasn't interested in an interview. Solitary confinement is another justice problem that's getting a lot more attention. The Intercept reported in January that Nebraska allows juveniles to be put in solitary for up to 90 days, even though this practice is considered by the United Nations and others as torture. As one teenager, Jacob Rusher, is quoted in the article, he was put in solitary because he'd broken his ankle, supposedly for his own safety. It was 23 hours a day alone, no TV or radio. You were in there with one book, a blanket, a mat, and a toothbrush. No art materials, no hobby items. Like many aspects of U.S. justice, this varies dramatically between states. The ACLU reported that neighboring states have much shorter time limits on juvenile solitary, between 1 and 5 days. There's also a racial element. Visible minorities are about 20% of Nebraska's overall juvenile population, but 55% of the juvenile prison population. To illustrate that sex crime laws in the U.S. fail at both ends of the spectrum, there was a recent case in Oklahoma where a boy was found not guilty of what was called forcible oral sodomy on a slightly younger girl who he had taken home from a party because she was dead drunk, i.e. unconscious the vast majority of the time. His DNA was found on her mouth and legs, but the judge ruled that Oklahoma law described the circumstances of forcible oral intercourse, but they don't include someone who couldn't resist because they were incapacitated by alcohol. If the sex had been vaginal or anal, it would have been covered by the law. Another example of what's a blatantly obvious sex crime not being prosecuted, or at least not resulting in a conviction. While at the other end of the spectrum, as our guest pointed out, public urination could be considered a sex crime if a prosecutor wants to handle it that way. Now let's go to some medical news. The New York Times reported on April 19th that doctors have reclassified a certain thyroid tumor as not a cancer. I discussed this problem of terminology with Peter Gotchi in my interview with him, one of the earliest interviews I did. The average person thinks of all tumors as cancerous, i.e. fast-growing, But this isn't necessarily true. It isn't true. The practical implication is that when the tumor is removed, this thyroid tumor, the patient now won't need to undergo other cancer treatments such as radiation. But there is a much more important point that the article by Gina Colata doesn't really address. When we are told that something is a cancer, it is just the opinion of a pathologist. It is not a fact. And even if all pathologists agree, it is mainly because they've all been trained in the same way. So before April, all pathologists agreed this was a cancer that needed aggressive treatment. After April, maybe they will all agree that it doesn't. It doesn't really mean that it's a fact. It's just the current state of agreement over the area of medicine. A similar problem occurs with breast cancer with in situ ductal carcinoma that is not a cancerous tumor, but is usually treated as if it was. If you were told that your breast had a carcinoma, what would you do? Right, tell the doctor, cut it out, irradiate it, poison it, which is exactly what the doctor wants you to think. The New York Times also reported on April 20th on the occurrence of an operation known as symphysiotomy, which they describe as a brutal childbirth operation which involves cutting through the cartilage and ligaments of the pelvic joint in order to make room for an obstructed delivery. It can cause chronic side effects like pelvic pain, difficulty walking, and in urinary incontinence. In most countries in Europe, these operations have not been used for a long time, but the operation was used in Ireland up till the 1980s, and one of the reasons that the New York Times describes is that doctors believed that if a woman had more than 3 cesarean sections, it was dangerous, and the Catholic Church didn't want to provide contraception to any women, even if getting pregnant was a physical danger to them, so they would perform these horrible operations. One 83-year-old woman, Rita O'Leary, is quoted as saying that she had continuous back pain for the following 50 years of her life. I was constantly limping because my pelvis hurt. It was difficult to go to the toilet, and I couldn't look after my child properly. It was humiliating. There is a compensation program in Ireland, but now the Irish government wants to destroy all records from women who don't claim compensation. This is important medical historical information. It's also an embarrassment to the government, and obviously they would like to get rid of it. Another embarrassment reported on May 2nd by the Toronto Star is that the top pediatrician at Canada's top pediatric hospital, Toronto's Sick Kids, has been caught as a co-author on a 2003 paper that covered up side effects of Risperdal, something I recently reported on. This antipsychotic can cause boys to grow huge breasts. This was reported in drafts of the paper, but it disappeared by the time it was published. Dr. Denis Daneman blames his co-authors from Janssen, the drug company that makes Risperdal, but that's no excuse. If you allow your name to be used on a paper without actually participating, that's as serious as actually participating in the cover-up of embarrassing medical data. Thank you for listening to our centenary episode 100 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can join the over 500 people who have liked the show at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.